Before we can solve climate change, we need to think of it as a human problem. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace Tech. I'm Molly Wood. Since last year on Marketplace Tech, we've been talking about how to adapt to climate change and how technology and the tech industry can help. But here's the part, even on a tech show, where we acknowledge that climate change isn't just about tech solutions or whiz-bang inventions. And in fact, like the pandemic, climate change is a problem that reflects and exposes lots of things about our society. Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson and Catherine Wilkinson co-edited a book called All We Can Save: Truth, Courage, and Solutions for the Climate Crisis. It features poems, essays, and other works of art by women working on climate issues. I spoke with them both. Wilkinson told me there's a lot in that subtitle.
We need to have eyes wide open to what is happening, listen to the science. We need courage. And then, of course, we need solutions. And not just the solutions that kind of the climate bros are really into, like EVs and solar panels. We definitely need those. Ayanna just got a Tesla.
So I think that's the trifecta, right? The truth, courage, and solutions. When people are like, well, if not hope, then what? That's our answer.
Yeah. When did we find ourselves at a point where we sort of stopped talking about climate as the thing we live, right? The air we breathe, the rain that falls or doesn't fall. Do you think it's important to, like, even before we start talking about solutions, to recenter the conversation as a human problem?
Yeah, even though we didn't cause this problem, it's in fact 100 corporations who are responsible for 71% of emissions. There is a wide range of possible futures. And we so deliberately curated this book to show the wide range of ways that people can contribute to building the best possible future. So it includes farmers and architects and artists and journalists and, of course, scientists and policy experts and lawyers. And all of those skills are needed and very much wanted.
How much of this storytelling is also about making the simple economic argument that saving people also saves money?
When we talk about sort of the cost-benefit analysis of doing various things to address the climate crisis, we usually only focus on the costs as opposed to making sure that we are also thinking about the benefits. And I think that is quite bolstering to me as a marine ecologist by training and thinking about nature-based solutions and how protecting and restoring nature actually, like, makes financial sense, because it's cheaper to have mangroves and marshes and seagrasses than seawalls, right, for example. Mm. So I think this book really shows not just some sort of techno-utopian version of the future where we, like, innovate our way out of everything. And instead, it talks about the huge array of work that needs doing and the costs of not doing it and what the world could look like for the better if we do.
I feel like this conversation about racial justice, climate justice, social justice, the importance of involving women in these conversations, how many women are leading solutions all over the world, is still kind of new and still kind of nascent.
Which is so lame, but you're right.
Which is pretty lame, but maybe take some explaining, you know? Like, what is this relationship between racial justice and climate change, and why don't people understand that?
I think we don't understand it because we don't want to, because it complicates something that is already really hard, right? Like, that's the pushback that I hear most often. It's not like, I'm a racist and I want to save the planet. It's more like solving climate change is hard enough without bringing in all these other layers. Can we just please focus on climate change now first and we'll deal with, like, police not murdering black people for no reason later? And the answer is no. Mm-hmm. No, we can't. We have to walk and chew gum on this one. And there are many reasons for that. One is just it's the right thing to do. And so I hate having to give other reasons. But one of those other reasons is, you know, we know from polling by Yale and George Mason universities that people of color actually are more concerned about the climate crisis. They're more motivated to be a part of the solution and to hold the politicians to higher standards on climate policy. But how can we expect Black people to be focused on climate solutions when making sure they have the basic right to live and breathe. And so this "I can't breathe" has become a rallying cry across, you know, across the racial and climate justice groups, that it's not just in relation to police brutality, but in the ways that communities of color are burdened with more polluted air and where, you know, or where power plants decide to locate themselves. And then, you know, people who are breathing that dirty air being more at risk for extreme forms of COVID. And so, of course, these things are all connected. And wouldn't it be great if we were building the winning team by including the people who were already on board and wanted to help? And if we could unburden them from sort of our white supremacist patriarchy, which is certainly not serving us in terms of really anything, but definitely it's preventing a lot of people from being a part of climate solutions because, you know, they have to dedicate their time and energy and ingenuity towards solving other problems about quality of life and justice.
And I just want to add, because I think Ayanna articulates this so incredibly well, that when we think about climate change as quote unquote the problem, I think that's where we start to miss these intersections and entanglements. When we understand actually that climate change is a manifestation of the problem, right? It's emerging out of a system that we're getting so much feedback that it's not working. Racial violence is part of that feedback. Massive wealth inequality is part of that feedback. The epidemics of loneliness and meaninglessness are part of that feedback. And also an atmosphere that, as Kate Marvel says, is larded with carbon dioxide and is having all of these climatic impacts. That's also part of the feedback. But if we're just thinking about climate change as the problem we need to solve, then our analysis isn't deep enough about what's actually going on here, and thus what it's actually going to take to solve it.
Catherine Wilkinson and Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson co-edited the book All We Can Save: Truth, Courage, and Solutions for the Climate Crisis. And now for some related links. Wildfires are still burning in California. New ones sprang up over the weekend. Millions of acres have burned, dozens have died, many more have lost homes and businesses. And a story from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento says this year's fire season is actually rewriting some extreme weather forecasting models that simply had never accounted for fires of this size. For example, satellite data shows that fires have gotten significantly worse from 1984 through 2017, as climate trends, like hotter, drier summers, made it easier for fires to start and burn longer. But one climate scientist told the station that the August complex, the largest fire in California's history, was still three times the size of the largest fire that he and his team had ever created in a climate simulation. Also, in fun climate stories, apparently climate change is making another weird anomaly much more common: zombie storms, where storms that initially appeared to die out spring back to life out over the ocean when they hit warm water and moist air that didn't used to be there. Tropical Storm Paulette is an example that happened a little earlier this month. And meteorologists say zombie storms is a relatively new term, but a phenomenon that's likely to become a lot more common. Because, I mean, really, let's be honest, it was only a matter of time before 2020 threw zombies in the mix. I'm Molly Wood, and that's Marketplace Tech. This is APM.